Chapter 15. Suffering and Ceasing to Suffer. The Sutta. Again, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects in terms of the Four Noble Truths. And how does a bhikkhu abide contemplating mind objects as mind objects in terms of the Four Noble Truths? Here, a bhikkhu understands as it actually is. This is suffering. He understands as it actually is. This is the origin of suffering. He understands as it actually is. This is the cessation of suffering. And he understands as it actually is. This is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. Buddhist tradition makes a distinction between those teachings that require interpretation and those that do not. The Buddha's statement in the Dhammapada that hatred never ceases by hatred is literally true, and the truth of it can be seen quite clearly in everyday life, except, of course, by those who are blinded by the desire for revenge. There are other teachings, however, that require us to go beyond the literal meaning, demanding a prior knowledge of the Dharma before we can understand them. A good example is that of one of the Buddha's most famous teachings, the Four Noble Truths, to which the Satipatthana Sutta now directs our attention. It is not often realized that when the Buddha speaks of suffering, its origin, and its cessation, he is using that as an example of how things arise and cease. It is not a definitive statement. In terms of another traditional distinction, it is method rather than doctrine. It is worth giving careful thought to this. Hearing these truths, people often conclude that Buddhism is suffering-oriented, inward-looking, and self-centered, as though the idea was to become immersed in one's own suffering and how to alleviate it. But this is not what the Buddha is saying. What is usually translated as suffering is the Pali term dukkha, which points to the fact that conditioned existence, taken as a whole, is unsatisfactory and frustrating. But this does not mean that Buddhists view life as unremittingly painful and unpleasant, which it obviously is not. On the other hand, we can be sure that the Buddha did not choose this example of the workings of conditionality at random. It is salutary to reflect on the inherent unsatisfactoriness of things, like reflecting on the loathsomeness of the body. It is an example of bending the bamboo the other way. We are not being asked to stop finding life agreeable, if that is our experience, but to acknowledge that, however agreeable it may be, it is never wholly so. Dukkha is pain and sickness, but it is also lack of complete fulfillment. It is anxiety and loss, bitterness and cynicism, a sense of lengthening shadows. It is also the truth that even pleasant circumstances cannot last forever, inasmuch as they arise within conditioned existence. The possibility of escaping suffering through a cutting off of conditioned consciousness is illustrated in detail by the teaching of the 12 Nidanas, which map out the cycle of conditionality that so often characterizes our existence. It is possible, however, to withdraw from unskillful states of consciousness by disengaging from the reactive cycle at certain all-important points, and this is the aim of our practice. In the absence of any given link in the chain, the succeeding link cannot arise, and eventually this will have the effect of removing suffering altogether. The method of reflection here is one advocated throughout the Pali Canon. You begin by observing an object and noticing how it has come about due to definite conditioning factors. The object of your scrutiny might be dukkha, which arises through desire and attachment, or anything else, food for example. Then you see that by removing these originating factors, you can make it impossible for the object itself to arise. And this method can be applied to conditioned existence as a whole. in the Pali canon, enlightenment is associated with the cutting off of cyclic conditionality, so as to stop the spinning of the wheel of life and go utterly beyond future rebirth. In other words, enlightenment is described in terms of what it is not. The term Nibbana, or in Sanskrit Nirvana, literally means extinction, an extinguishing or blowing out of the flame of conditioned existence. And the Pali texts also describe it as uncreated and unending, uncompounded, indiscernible, and so on. Given the inadequacy of language to exhaust transcendental meaning, it is little wonder that, when faced with the task of communicating reality, the early Buddhists, and perhaps even the Buddha himself, hesitated to say too much about it. But this use of, as it were, negative terms has had its consequences in modern times. When the Pali Canon first began to be known in the West, the description of enlightenment in terms of cessation, like the idea that life is suffering, had a profoundly negative influence on the popular conception of Buddhist thought. Lacking a wider understanding of the doctrine, the early translators could only take these terms literally and thus propagate a view of the Dharma as a teaching of almost unrelieved pessimism, emphasizing giving up the world and cutting off the karma-producing reactivity of the mundane mind, while giving little sense of the positivity and expansiveness to which the path leads. The attainment of Nibbana certainly represents a decisive and permanent shift away from cyclical conditionality, but it is not a snuffing out of the life principle. Nibbana is not annihilation. This is in fact made quite clear in the Pali texts. The Buddha frequently speaks the language of development, characterizing the path as a way of progressively refining one's status of consciousness, and thus bringing about an ever-increasing experience of positivity and well-being. This finds most detailed expression in the teaching of the 12 positive nidanas, or links, the counterpart of the nidanas of the Tibetan Wheel of Life, which describes spiritual life not as a cutting off of the negative cycle of mundane conditionality, but in terms of the cultivation of the seeds of positivity that are also to be found within mundane existence. The positive nidanas show the growth of consciousness as it moves upwards from the wheel of life to describe a spiral of ever more positive and insightful states, leading all the way to enlightenment. Its method is to place a positive interpretation on the shortcomings of conditioned existence, pointing out that in dependence upon birth there arises not only the sequence of old age, decay, and death, as depicted on the wheel of life, but also the potential realization that birth, old age, and death are inherently unsatisfactory. This leads to faith in the path, and from this point onwards, consciousness continues to expand through faith to joy, rapture, serenity, bliss, concentration, knowledge and vision of things as they really are, liberation, and finally, the knowledge that the poisons have been destroyed. This is effectively enlightenment itself. But even this version of the path can make it sound rather schematic and alien from the felt experience of our ideals as human beings. It might be better to imagine a day of unfettered inspiration and free-flowing energy, a day in which you are able to be completely true and clear in your communication, a day in which you felt so real a connection with others that your own concerns ceased to loom so balefully over your life, a day in which you never felt as though you were banging your head against a brick wall or getting stuck in a rut. Imagine such a day of creative freedom, and then imagine that freedom doubled or trebled and continuing to expand, and you will start to get an idea of the nature of enlightenment. So, although the Buddha did sometimes express weariness with conditioned existence, especially in the days before he became enlightened, a full account of his teaching needs to place the doctrine of cessation side by side with its positive counterpart, or even give the latter more emphasis. It is hard to conceive of a process or path without a final goal, but to think of nirvana as a fixed state at which one arrives and settles down is just as mistaken as any other way in which the dualistic mind might try to grasp and tie down the ineffable in words and ideas of its own devising. The Buddha's reluctance to provide a substantial description of the enlightened state points only to the inadequacy of dualistic language. In any case, given the vitality that characterizes the path of awareness, the notion of some final state in which one remains perfected and immutable does seem strangely inadequate. Literal-mindedness is a great handicap in the spiritual life, and we have to remember that we are prone to it. We simply cannot afford to think of enlightenment as the elimination of the ego without putting anything positive in its place, because if we take this elimination literally, as we are likely to do, we will be left with the idea of annihilation, which is just as untrue to enlightenment as any other idea might be. It is unthinkable that the state of enlightenment could be merely a snuffing out of all dynamism or a quiescent state of inactivity, however refined or contented that state might be. But there is a long way to go, although it is no distance at all, before we experience that for ourselves. We have to start where we are, and when it comes to reflecting on the Four Noble Truths, we do well to pay particular attention to the second one, that of the origin of suffering. Dukkha, we are told, arises in dependence upon craving, and crucially, dissolves when craving ceases. This merits careful reflection, because the idea that there could be a direct connection between suffering and craving runs counter to our instinctive response to dukkha. We tend to think of craving not as the root of the problem, but as the pointer to its solution. Our natural tendency is to look for something that will solve our problem by satisfying our desires. And of course this works in some situations. When we are hungry, we want food, and food does indeed satisfy us, refreshing our body and keeping us going. That is perfectly healthy. But craving is the hunger not of physical need, but of emotional emptiness. When we are experiencing craving, we want something, anything, something to read, someone to talk to, something to eat that will fill that gap, mop up that moment of discomfort. In the grip of craving, we wolf down our food to keep misery, shame, and emptiness at bay, or try to snatch happiness from sex or power or money to assuage our aching emptiness. We can even have a craving for meditative states, looking for quick results, and getting impatient when they don't materialize. We crave company, looking to other people to make us happy, using them to plug the gap in our positivity. We crave annihilation even, imagining that oblivion will solve our problems. The object of craving is not the issue. Craving is craving. An important aspect of mindfulness is the understanding that this sense of emptiness or incompleteness arises in dependence on definite causes and conditions. At any one time, we are reaping the fruits of past actions and performing the actions that will produce fruits in the future. The discomfort of neurotic attachment, itself produced by craving, produces further craving. In order to break this vicious circle, it is therefore necessary, at least at the start of our spiritual life, to be prepared simply to experience that craving, or stifled energy, or inner void, and try not to satisfy it, or release it, or fill it. This sense of insufficiency or inadequacy goes very deep, and it will take us a lot deeper into our experience if we can resist the lure of superficial pleasure. The third noble truth, that of the cessation of dukkha, or nibbana, will never be achieved through trying to avoid dukkha. Likewise, the cultivation of positive mental states will never be achieved through bypassing difficult ones. It is wrong to romanticize suffering, which rarely ennobles and often degrades and brutalizes. But if you are attempting to lead a spiritual life, you're going to experience a certain amount of suffering simply because you are no longer papering over your discomfort with distractions. When the text says that the bhikkhu understands each of the four noble truths as it actually is, this means that he understands them as part of his experience. That is, he has some real insight into them. But how can we approach this? What does this practice actually feel like? When you practice mindfulness of the unsatisfactory nature of conditioned existence, moment by moment, you notice that dukkha is only part of any experience. There is always more to what is going on than simply dukkha. You notice too that the forms in which dukkha arises change moment by moment. You might become aware of a pull towards reacting to your experience with craving at one moment, then with aversion the next. You might recognize dukkha within very pleasant feeling in the form of some slight wisp of dissatisfaction, and then see where that dissatisfaction comes from, noticing that it arises from a desire for that pleasant feeling to continue, or from a slight anxiety, or conceit, or restlessness, or doubt. Having noticed this, you may then be able to let go of it, or put conditions into place that will allow you to let go of it. Alternatively, you might notice that when you are experiencing craving, it always comes with a feeling of distress, and that if you stop feeding the craving, that distress will give way to a sense of freedom. You might then contemplate your experience of the absence of craving, at least in its more obvious forms, as well as the consequent experience of the cessation of suffering, however temporary and partial this might be. And you could go on to contemplate whatever understanding of the principle of conditionality might then arise. Finally, you could contemplate whatever understanding you have of the Noble Eightfold Path as the way to the cessation of suffering. You could take account of the degree to which you are giving attention to the constituents of the path, the extent to which you are treating your practice as a full-time occupation rather than an occasional quick fix. You can also bear in mind the general nature of the path. Taken as a whole, it represents a combination of realism and positivity. Even though our working method needs to be directed to the eradication of unskillful states, the path itself is positive and progressive. True, we are aiming to stop the wheel of life revolving, that is, to put a stop to our own unskillful states of consciousness. But that is only half the truth. We also want to develop our potential as human beings and to feel confident that the Dharma will help us to grow. In other words, the sutta is describing the path as a creative process. And the so-called path is not something outside of ourselves. It is the creative mind itself. Whereas the reactive mind drifts in a desultory way from happiness to misery and back again, depending on circumstances, the creative mind changes this process into a progressive path. Indeed, it is that progressive path. Instead of drifting on the winds and tides of the world, you fix upon a clear goal, and even against a headwind, you tack back and forth, sometimes obliquely, but maintaining a steady course. Dukkha is placed at the heart of Buddhism because it is what stimulates us to act, to do something about our situation, to alleviate our discomfort. Of course, time after time, we act mistakenly. We do the wrong thing, and we fail to escape that discomfort. but at least we want to do something about it. The second and third noble truths show us where we have been going wrong, and the fourth suggests how we can act in a way that is more in tune with the way things are. In other words, we are exhorted to look at the unpalatable facts of life, not in a spirit of dismal Jimmyism, but so that we can do something about them. Dukkha comes from the fruitless search for permanence in a world where everything is impermanent. But impermanence is painful only as long as we insist on treating the things and people we like as if they were going to last forever. In contemplating the truth of Dukkha, we should be careful not to confuse the form of the teaching with the reality that it is designed to reveal to us. It is indeed the truth that will set us free. The Sutta. In this way, he abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects internally, or he abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects externally, or he abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects both internally and externally. Or else he abides contemplating in mind objects their arising factors, or he abides contemplating in mind objects their vanishing factors, or he abides contemplating in mind objects both their arising and vanishing factors. Or else mindfulness that there are mind objects is simply established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness. And he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is how Bhikkhu abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects, in terms of the Four Noble Truths. We owe the original compilers of the Pali Canon an enormous debt of gratitude. For several centuries, a vast literature was preserved with, as far as we know, a reasonable degree of accuracy, entirely by word of mouth. But because the Satipatthana Sutta was not primarily a literary text, it is difficult, even impossible, to determine what of the material we now have is original and what was added later, although there are some clues to suggest that the text we have is a hybrid dating from more than one period. The version of the Four Noble Truths in the Sutta, for example, is strikingly brief compared to the more detailed version in the Digha Nikaya, being little more than a simple statement of the existence of the truths and an instruction to contemplate them. Moreover, the absence of any further explanation is in contrast to the detailed descriptions of the parts of the body and the enlightenment factors given earlier in the sutta. It does not follow the same pattern, and this raises questions as to its place in the text as a whole. One might guess that it was included in the sutta almost as an afterthought. It is easy to imagine reasons for this. In the course of the centuries after the teaching was first given, some material will inevitably have been added and some removed. Teachers in successive generations of the oral tradition might have sought, in good faith, to fill out their explications of the Satipatthana Sutta by adding more categories of mental objects and their attendant formulations. The sutta would have been passed on in that form, and then when the doctrines were eventually committed to writing, such additions would have become an accepted part of the written tradition. Some scholars think that the original discourse was simpler and had fewer categories, perhaps only the mindfulness of the body and breath. The contemplation of the feelings, mind and mental objects having been included at a later date. The fact that the teachings were handed down orally may have had another consequence. Some features of the sutta could have been carried forward mechanically from one section to another with little or no sense of their deeper significance. To have arranged and catalogued these thousands of teachings from memory was a tremendous feat, and it would not be surprising if the monks should sometimes have been more concerned with the preservation of the oral tradition than with any penetrating insight into its meaning. For all their brevity, the Four Noble Truths are still accompanied by the usual repetitions of internal and external contemplation and the factors conditioning their arising and dissolution. But how are we to understand the contemplation of the Noble Truths in these ways? They are not quite like the other sets of mental objects listed in the sutta. The hindrances, the fetters, and even the khandhas all arise and pass away, in dependence on conditions. But the Noble Truths are statements of principle, not factors of consciousness. And as such, they are not subject to origination and dissolution in the same way. One can only contemplate them as statements of fact. However, the contemplation of the Four Noble Truths is still a useful exercise. As already suggested, one can contemplate the extent to which one has experienced the truth of suffering, the extent to which one has realized the truth of its origin, and the extent to which one is following the Noble Eightfold Path that leads to the cessation of suffering. But this is not what the text actually says. It seems likely that this passage has been added as a matter of course in the form in which it appears in the earlier sections of the sutta, virtually word for word, regardless of whether or not it is really appropriate. One might further conclude that the inclusion throughout the sutta of the contemplations of mental objects externally and internally is symptomatic of the same mechanical approach. The recurrence of this phrase in such a variety of contexts, with no explanation as to its precise meaning, makes it difficult to be sure what is really meant by it. In his commentary on the sutta, Buddha Ghosha has no trouble explaining the external contemplation of the foulness of the 31 parts of the body, or of the decomposing corpse. By definition, practices that take an external object as their point of reference. But when it comes to the breathing, he skirts around the whole issue. We are left to infer either that the external aspect of the practice was so familiar that it needed no comment, or that it had been lost by the time the commentary was compiled, some 800 years after the Buddha gave the discourse, or, and this is perhaps most likely, that the instruction to contemplate the breathing externally was just added to the sutta at some point for the sake of completeness, with no thought as to what such contemplation might involve. It does seem entirely possible that over the years, less attention came to be paid to the external, other-regarding aspects of Buddhist practice, the emphasis instead coming to be placed on familiarity with the categories of the Abhidhamma. After all, anyone can practice the Metta Bhavana. You don't have to be a scholar. You don't even have to be able to read and write. Some Theravadins, even today, tend to look down on the practice as being essentially for lay people. Even though the Metta Sutta is one of the most frequently recited texts, it is not necessarily taken seriously any more than the commandment to love your neighbour as yourself is taken seriously by all Christians. Such is the effect of many hundreds of years of institutionalized religion. Although everyone might agree that loving kindness is a good thing, it seems that the editors of the sutta did not see the need to spell out the importance of this other-regarding attitude. But the further back you go in the history of the Buddhist tradition, the more significant this attitude seems to be. Buddhism, in other words, was never as individualistic as people sometimes think. It may well have been that the other-regarding aspect of the practice was second nature to the early Buddhists, and hence did not receive so full an emphasis in the oral tradition. The sutta contains only the most perfunctory references to anything beyond one's experience of oneself. The fourfold establishment of mindfulness apparently having come to be regarded as an all-sufficient method. It is easy to imagine how this might have been so. The Buddha's early followers would not have experienced the alienation from nature that characterizes the lives of so many people today. For them, the natural world was ever-present, and the forest glades and parks in which the monks and nuns meditated were highly conducive to the cultivation of enthusiasm and metta. These days we have to shut ourselves off from the clutter and disharmony of modern urban life, in which the cultivation of positive emotion is continually undermined. And in these circumstances, we are likely to find it difficult to contact our feelings in meditation. A relatively integrated and balanced person practicing the mindfulness of breathing will naturally and spontaneously feel goodwill towards other people. And for them, the method in the Satipatthana Sutta, as it has come down to us, will be quite sufficient. However, it is unlikely to be so for all of us. We have to make sure that we pay specific attention to the other regarding aspects of spiritual practice, both for their own sake and because they involve the deeper energies that remain untapped by a simple concentration. There is a dreadful lack of positivity in many people's lives, and to be positive is absolutely essential to spiritual life and growth. As modern Buddhists, we need all the help we can get from devotional practices and the Metta Bhavana. As well as meeting the needs of our own age, this approach has a sound basis in Buddhist thought. Whether or not they were part of the original teaching, the sutta's references to the external aspect of practice serves to remind us that the Buddhist path has a double emphasis. However important our subjective experience might be, and however much we need to work on our own growth and development as individuals, the other regarding aspects of Buddhist life are just as important. If your aim is ultimately to transcend the subject-object duality, you have to transcend the object just as much as the subject, the two being mutually dependent. The teaching of the Four Noble Truths is not just about getting rid of your own personal suffering. It is about getting rid of suffering itself, wherever it exists in the universe. As Shantideva says in the Bodhicharya Avatara, whether it is you that happens to be suffering, or somebody else, doesn't matter in the light of that aim. Any approach to the non-dual calls the whole idea of individualistic versus altruistic motivation into question. The more we progress in our individual growth and development, the more positive and creative will be our effect on everyone with whom we come into contact.